The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles mostly from the Harvard Heart Letter. And the first article from the Harvard Heart Letter is from the February 2024 issue, and it's entitled The Portfolio Diet, A Smart Investment for Your Heart. This eating pattern highlights a variety of plant-based foods that help to lower heart risk. The portfolio diet, which emphasizes plant foods rich in fiber and healthy fats, was conceived about 20 years ago. Since then, many studies have documented the diet's ability to lower harmful LDL cholesterol. But because none of these trials lasted any longer than 6 months, the portfolio diet's long-term returns were unknown. Now, new research suggests that the more closely you follow a portfolio-style eating pattern, the greater your protection against heart disease and stroke. Published in November 2023 in the journal Circulation, the study included 210,000 people who enrolled in three Harvard-led health studies in the 1980s and 1990s. Using data from diet questionnaires that participants filled out every 4 years, researchers scored each person's diet based on how well it complied with the portfolio eating pattern. After 30 years of follow-up, researchers compared the scores with the participants' health outcomes. People with higher scores, that is, people who followed the diet more closely, had a 14% lower risk of heart disease compared to those with lower scores. A lot of different foods can lower LDL cholesterol, but only by a little bit, about 5 to 10%. The idea behind the portfolio diet was to combine many of these foods together to get a larger reduction, said registered dietitian Andrea Glenn, a postdoctoral research fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and co-author of the study. Earlier studies found that the portfolio diet may lower LDL cholesterol as much as 30%. In the new study, people with higher portfolio diet scores not only had better cholesterol profiles, they also had lower blood levels of C-reactive protein and other inflammatory substances compared to people with lower scores, says Glenn. Inflammation is a key player in the buildup of fatty plaque inside arteries, the root cause of most heart attacks. What is the portfolio diet? The diet discourages foods from animal sources, particularly red and processed meat, high-fat dairy, and eggs, which means it's naturally low in saturated fat and dietary cholesterol, both of which raise LDL cholesterol in the body. The featured foods fall into five main categories. Here's a rundown, including ways to incorporate them into your meals. The first is plant protein. This includes beans, lentils, and peas, with a specific focus on foods made from soybeans, says Glenn. In 1999, the FDA authorized a health claim for soy protein, noting that consuming at least 25 grams daily as part of a diet low in cholesterol and saturated fat may lower the risk of heart disease. Soy protein comes in many different forms, including edamame, which is whole green soybeans, sold frozen in pods, soy milk, soy yogurt, tofu, or tempeh, which is fermented soybeans. But there are many other legumes to choose from, including black beans, pinto beans, chickpeas, lentils, and split dried green peas. Then there are nuts and seeds, All nuts, including almonds, cashews, hazelnuts, pecans, pistachios, and walnuts are included. So are all types of seeds, including chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds, pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, and sesame. Then there is viscous fiber. Viscous fiber is a type of soluble fiber that has a somewhat sticky quality. It's found in grains like oats and barley, certain vegetables like eggplant and okra, and fruits like apples, oranges, berries, and persimmons. One of the best sources is psyllium seed husks, which transform into a viscous gel when dissolved in water. People may be familiar with psyllium because the powdered husks are a key ingredient in Metamucil, which helps to treat constipation. But you can buy plain psyllium seed husk in stores. In the intestines, viscous fiber binds to bile acids, which carry fat from your small intestine into the large intestine for excretion. This triggers your liver to create more bile acids, a process that requires cholesterol. If the liver doesn't have enough cholesterol, it draws more from the bloodstream, in turn lowering your circulating LDL. In addition, viscous fiber is fermented in the gut into short-chain fatty acids, which may also inhibit cholesterol production. The author, Ms. Glenn, suggests a super portfolio breakfast of oatmeal topped with soy milk, fruit, nuts, and seeds. Try a combination like raspberries, chopped walnuts, and chia seeds, or diced apples, almonds, and sesame seeds. Swap regular bread for oat bran bread. Plant sterols. Also known as phytosterols, these exist naturally in nuts, soybeans, peas, and canola oil. Plant sterols have a structure similar to cholesterol. Eating them helps to limit the amount of cholesterol your body can absorb. Margarine enriched with plant sterols like Benecol provides a concentrated dose, but you have to eat quite a bit, like 4 tablespoons a day, to make a difference, says Glenn. It tastes similar to other types of margarine. It can be used as a spread for toast and in sandwiches. Then there are monounsaturated fats. Used in place of saturated fats, these fats help to lower cholesterol. Extra virgin olive oil is the top recommendation. Other good options include canola oil, soybean or high oleic sunflower, or safflower oils. Stock a variety of these oils for use on salads and in cooking. Avocados are also rich in monounsaturated fat. You don't need to embrace every aspect of the diet to reap a benefit, says Glenn, but we saw a dose-related response in the study, which means that more of these foods were added to the diet, the lower the risk of cardiovascular disease that we observed. Harvard Heart Letter. Here's a section called Ask the Doctor. And the subject of this is, what's the best anti-clotting drug for atrial fibrillation? The question is, I have atrial fibrillation and take Xarelto, but I heard about a study that suggests Eliquis is more effective for preventing strokes in people with atrial fibrillation. I'm wondering if I should switch. What are your thoughts? And the answer comes from Dr. Christopher Cannon, who is the editor in charge of the Harvard Heart Letter. Both of these anti-clotting medications, rivaroxaban or Xarelto, and apixaban or Eliquis, are FDA approved for preventing strokes in people with atrial fibrillation. They both belong to a class of drugs known as direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs. They work by inhibiting a substance called factor 10A, which plays a key role in blood clot formation. Both drugs have a half-life of about 8 hours, which means that the blood level of the drug drops by half over an 8-hour period. But there are many differences. The standard dose of rivaroxaban, that's Xarelto, for preventing strokes due to atrial fibrillation is a 20 milligram pill once a day. After you take the pill, the blood levels are high over the following hours, but the level drops by half within 8 hours. As a result, there's a large difference in the peak level versus the lowest level. In contrast, most people take apixaban, that's Eliquis, in a 5 milligram pill twice a day. Compared to rivaroxaban, the peak blood levels are not as high, and the lower level is not as low. High levels of an anti-clotting drug can lead to bleeding, while lower levels may increase the risk of blood clot formation. As such, it makes sense that the twice-a-day dosing would have a lower risk of bleeding and potentially better clot prevention. The study you're referring to, which looked at health records of more than 580,000 people who were prescribed either drug, support that assumption. People taking apixaban, remember that's Xarelto, experienced lower rates of both bleeding and clotting events. This was an observational trial, which means there may have been more differences between the people who were given one drug versus the other, and those differences could explain the results. Only a blinded, randomized clinical trial that controls for those possible differences can provide a more definitive answer. There is no clinical trial comparing rivaroxaban to apixaban, but both drugs have been pitted against warfarin or Coumadin, an older medication that was the mainstay for clot prevention before DOACs were approved. The findings seem to support the trend shown by the large observational trial. That is, apixaban compared to warfarin had lower rates of bleeding, stroke, and death, whereas rivaroxaban had no significant difference in these events compared to warfarin. With only these indirect comparisons, we can't say for sure that apixaban is better than a rivaroxaban. The downside to apixaban is that you have to take it twice a day. People who are likely to forget their second dose may be better off taking rivaroxaban. And one more time, remember, rivaroxaban is Xarelto, apixaban is Eliquis. Talk to your doctor about whether it makes sense for you to switch. Now here's another article from the Harvard Heart Letter of February 2024. It's called How a Personal Trainer Can Enhance Your Workouts. Many people seek motivation, but working with a trainer can also help you avoid injuries and make exercise more enjoyable. If your New Year's resolution to start exercising has fallen by the wayside, hiring a personal trainer can be a good way to hold yourself accountable. Exercise is such an important part of cardiovascular health. The cost is worthwhile, especially when you consider the added benefit of working with a professional trainer. A good personal trainer will create a balanced workout and teach you how to exercise safely to avoid injuries, says certified personal trainer Vijaya Daryanani, a physical therapist with Harvard-affiliated Spalding Outpatient Center. He always has his clients start with a dynamic warm-up, like marching in place or sidestepping and doing arm swings, which helps loosen up the major muscle groups. I'll also have them do some heel-to-toe walking to help fire up some of the smaller muscles. People focused on heart health often prioritize exercise that raises their heart rate. But strength training builds lean muscle mass, which helps to burn body fat, keeps blood sugar in check, and may help to reduce cholesterol level. Using the proper form during strength building exercises is key. The weight machines at gyms and fitness centers can be a good option for beginners because they target specific muscle groups within a limited range of motion, says Dariani. But when you use free weights like dumbbells, barbells, and kettlebells, you use a much wider range of muscles, including core muscles and others that help with stability and balance. A trainer will help you to choose the correct type and size of free weight based on your abilities and goals. Because free weights allow a greater range of motion, you need good body awareness to stay safe. Always be sure to stand up straight and tall before starting any standing strength move, says Dariani. Most gyms and health clubs have mirrors that you can use to get feedback on your form as you exercise. Even a basic body weight exercise like a squat requires careful attention to body alignment to avoid straining your joints. But how do you choose a personal trainer? Some gyms and fitness centers have personal trainers on staff or hire them as contractors. But many will come to your house and can devise an at-home workout plan for you, even if you don't own any machine or special equipment. Look for one who is accredited by one or more of these organizations: the American Council on Exercise, the American College of Sports Medicine, International Sports Sciences Association, and the National Academy of Sports Medicine. Ask about the person's training background, experience working with clients your age, and approach to designing client programs. Consider asking for references, especially from clients like you. Sign up for a few sessions at first to gauge how well you and the trainer work together before you commit to something longer. Prices vary widely, depending on where you live and possibly gym affiliations. The cost ranges anywhere from $75 to $125 per hour. You might be able to save a little money by hiring a trainer to do small group sessions with you and one or several of your friends who have similar fitness levels and goals. Another advantage to working with a trainer: a good one can make exercise feel like a fun challenge instead of a repetitive chore. Getting someone in the right mindset is essential, and I find that positive energy can be very infectious, says Dariani. Now, just for a change of pace, let's look at some shorter articles under the heading of Research We're Watching. Again, this is the Harvard Heart Letter of February 2024. And the first section is, mindfulness may help people stick to a heart-healthy diet. A mindfulness training program may help people with high blood pressure follow a heart-healthy diet, according to a study in the November 2nd, 2023 issue of JAMA Network Open. For the study, 101 people attended the 8-week training program, which teaches people skills like meditation, self-awareness, and emotional regulation. These skills are then directed toward behaviors known to lower the blood pressure, including following the DASH diet. The 100 people in the control group received brochures about controlling high blood pressure. Over 6 months, people in the mindfulness group began eating more in line with the DASH diet than those in the control group by adding changes like an extra daily serving of vegetables. They also showed improvements in their ability to sense and interpret hunger and satiety, greater self-awareness may also help people to notice how different types of food make them feel and to be more cognizant of their eating habits, the authors noted. The next article in research we're watching is poor sleep is linked to next day episodes of atrial fibrillation. When people with atrial fibrillation sleep poorly, they may be more likely to have an episode of atrial fibrillation the next day, a new study finds. The study included 419 people with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, which is characterized by intermittent episodes of rapid irregular heartbeat. For 10 weeks, they used a smartphone app to rate their nightly sleep as amazing, good, average, bad, or horrible, and then used mobile electrocardiograms to measure atrial fibrillation episodes the following day. Researchers found that worse sleep quality on any given night was linked to a 15% greater risk of an atrial fibrillation episode the next day. Continued poor sleep was associated with longer episodes of atrial fib, which with each progressively worse category of sleep linked with an average of 16 additional minutes of atrial fibrillation per day. Strategies to improve sleep might help to prevent and to treat atrial fibrillation, say the authors, whose findings were published online in the October 2023 issue of JACC Clinical Electrophysiology. The next article in the Harvard Heart Letter is, do you need to check for narrowed arteries in your neck? Carotid artery ultrasounds are advisable only in a few specific circumstances. Have you ever gotten a flyer in the mail advertising a simple, painless ultrasound screening that can identify dangerous plaque buildup? When offered by commercial companies, these tests are typically done in churches, recreation centers, or mobile vans. But they're also done at accredited medical facilities. One of the tests in the screening looks at the carotid arteries, which run up either side of your neck and supply blood to your brain. Like arteries in the heart and elsewhere in the body, the carotid arteries can become clogged with fatty deposits that narrow the path for blood to flow. But contrary to what you might assume, checking for this problem, called carotid stenosis, rarely makes sense, especially with a screening test done by a for-profit company. The trouble with the commercial screening tests is that they have a lot of false positives. People aren't sure what the results mean, and they may end up feeling terrified for no reason, says cardiologist Dr. Marie Gerhardt Herman, associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. A false positive result suggests the presence of significant stenosis that is not really there. It can lead to additional testing and worry, and possibly unneeded treatment. By the time people reach their late 70s, it's not unusual for the carotid arteries to show signs of thickening. But only about 1 in 100 people in the general population has significant carotid artery stenosis. Carotid stenosis usually doesn't cause any harm unless the narrowing is particularly severe, a blockage of 70% or greater. The plaque can break open and a clot can form that cuts off blood supply to part of the brain, an emergency known as an ischemic stroke. But carotid stenosis is to blame for only about 1 in 10 ischemic strokes, according to a nationwide database. There are only a few specific circumstances when a carotid artery ultrasound is definitely recommended, says Dr. Gerhard Herman. The overwhelming majority of these cases are in people with signs or symptoms of carotid stenosis. One possible sign is a distinctive whooshing sound called a bruit that a doctor can hear through a stethoscope placed over the artery. Caused by turbulent blood flow through the narrowed artery, a bruit sounds like water flowing over rocks in the middle of a stream, says Dr. Gerhard Herrmann. Carotid ultrasounds are routine in people with symptoms of transient ischemia, or TIA, or a mini stroke, which usually disappear within an hour, but may persist for as long as 24 hours. These symptoms often include eye issues, most commonly a sudden loss of vision that people often describe as a curtain coming down over one eye. Others include trouble speaking. And then, just briefly, about 20 minutes of exercise may offset risk of sitting all day. According to the Harvard Heart Letter, just 22 minutes of brisk walking or similar activities daily may offset the risk of prolonged sitting, new research suggests. The study was based on health and activity tracker data on nearly 12,000 people aged 50 and older. People who spent more than 12 hours a day sitting were 38% more likely to die during the study period than people who sat for just 8 hours a day. But the increased risk of death was only seen in people who got less than 22 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity. The findings were adjusted to account for confounding factors like smoking, alcohol, and disease. The study appeared in the November 2023 issue of the British Journal of Sports Medicine. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.